Hello there, my name's Kat Ellinger. I'm an author, editor and critic. This is Angelo Panaccio's very bizarre, very bewildering in a way, giallo gothic hybrid, Sex of the Witch from 1973. A film that tends to confuse a lot of people because in terms of its narrative construction and also the way that it uses typical genre tropes, it's not a film that really complies to any form of genre convention, which is one of the reasons I love it, because it's like kind of a wild frontier. You can recognise it as a giallo of sorts. You can recognise the gothic aspects in it. But it's a film that leaves a lot of people quite often sitting there saying, what the hell is going on? What did I just watch? What is that? Before I get right into the film, though, and it's a film that is shrouded in mystery in a lot of ways. Even actress Camille Keaton admitted a couple of times in interviews that she had no clue what this film was about when she was making it. And neither did some of her fellow cast members. So even they didn't know what the film was about. But I think before we get into that, there's some really, really important context to consider. And so I'm going to kick off with that because it's part of the mystery, but it also explains the film's strange structure and the fact that it seems to even deliberately defy genre convention, narrative coherence, which has frequently been read as inept, but I don't think of it that way. I think there's something else going on here. And so I'm going to kick off with my theory to add this, I guess, scene setting before we get into the real nitty-gritty of the film. Mostly, though, I want to recount this backstory because I just think it's absolutely wild. So I'll talk about Angelo Panaccio a little bit later on, but let's just say he was somebody who really worked on an Ello Panaccio, is he's there credited as screenwriter. Panaccio was a very fringe figure in Italian exploitation, not particularly prolific. And what he did, and I'll expand on this later on in the commentary, was set up these not very successful film production companies, mostly throughout the 70s, try and get these very low budget projects set up with him as director and usually credited as screenwriter as well. But in commercial terms, it was just failure after failure. Now, the thing that interests me the most about this setup is the fact that on this, uncredited as screenwriter, was a figure called Franco Braccani. Franco Braccani is a fascinating figure. Again, very much on the fringes, but somebody whose philosophy on life, on art, on cinema was diametrically opposed to what Italians were doing in commercial genre cinema at the time, which was all about making money. It was all about exploitation. It was about making money. And of course, art occurred within that sector, but it was a brutal landscape that was very much focused on market economics. Franco Braccani was an outsider. He was a deeply experimental underground filmmaker. And so the fact that he wrote the script for this just astounds me. It just blows my mind completely. Because this is a guy whose view on cinema, his philosophy on cinema, he was part of an underground movement who, much like the French New Wave, a decade before, they got a much later start, so it was really in the 70s. that this kicked off for them, or the late 60s, say. A little bit later, but they were kind of enmeshed with the initial philosophy of the Nouvelle Vague, in that what they wanted to do was deconstruct traditional cinema. Franco Bracani was a rebel. He wanted to deconstruct traditional cinema, deconstruct traditional narrative and the films that he made from the mid-60s onwards himself. So he mainly did short films, a lot of them on the art world and on cultural figures. But his biggest sort of, I'd say biggest, but he's so obscure. But a lot of Eurocult fans might have come across his main feature, Necropolis, from 1970 in the peripheral, like I did, because it's a film that, a very, very experimental film that uses horror figures to give this strange essay on the meaning of life and death and evil in humanity. So you've got Bathory in there, who's played by Viva, the Warhol superstar. You've got Frankenstein's creature in there, but it's a very, very experimental work. And Bracani's whole outlook on the film industry was anti-commercialism. What's even more interesting is Bracani, from the mid-60s onwards, he started hanging around with this painter, this very avant-garde artist called Mario Scifano. And one of the few places you can read about Bracani and his outlook and his work, because like I said, he is a very obscure figure, is in the biography that was written on Scifano, which unfortunately hasn't been translated to English language. Scifano, though, as an artist, was somebody who was very much ensconced in this high culture, cool scene of the 60s. So, for example, he spent time in New York. He got to know Andy Warhol really well and all the Warhol factory people. He knew the Rolling Stones. He hung out with Keith Richards a lot. And at one point even had a love affair with Marianne Faithfull. This is Scifano. And back in Italy, he's hanging out with people like Pasolini, Marco Ferreri. And so there are a lot of stories in this book, these crazy, wild stories about these very political, quote-unquote, artistic filmmakers, with Bracani in there. He starts collaborating with Mario Scifano when he moves from art to cinema, Scifano. And Bracani, in the same way, started in the art world. So they make this move into very experimental short film together. But you've got these crazy stories in this book about hanging out with Mick Jagger and hanging out with Warhol. And then they're at a party and Pasolini is calling Scifano not a real proletariat because his dad was an archaeologist, and they're having this massive row. And Marco Ferreri's there getting stoned, and Rod Razumov, sister of the wonderful Ivan from the Giallo, is there stripping off all her clothes, stoned out of her face. So this is where Franco Bracani came from. And when you look at Necropolis, it has a lot of Mario Scifano's friends in it. So Viva, for example, from the Warhol factory is in it. Pierre Clemente, who was another good friend of Mario's, Tina Almond. Like, these real kind of art house figures are in this film. And this is Franco Bracani. And before I continue with Bracani, I need to cut in here and say that for people familiar with this film already, you may have noticed this cut is slightly different. And that's because this new restoration from Vinegar Syndrome has unearthed some of the previously cut scenes, which were not even around on the grey area bootleg market. They had completely vanished. So they've been restored for this release, including this wonderful coffin sex scene. And obviously, Italy in 1973, it's opening up, excuse the pun, slightly more than previously, but there were certain things that were still seen as being a little bit too close to the knuckle. And I guess this quite explicit a sex scene in a coffin during a man's final moments and when he dies, his last breath, was probably seen as a little bit too much. So I'll try and pop in and point these out as they appear during this new restoration. Such is the wonder of the process of new restorations, though, because you never know what is going to show up and what's going to be found. And it just really is such a wonderful art in that respect, because you often hear of bits that were cut out of these Italian films, but you never see them. And thankfully, it's not the case here, so we get to see them. Back to Bracani, though, who was a part of this counterculture art circle, a very political, sometimes very experimental artists and filmmakers who set out with a manifesto to deconstruct film. And I know this is taking me 10 minutes to get to the punchline, but somehow, and for some reason, and this is one of the great mysteries of this film, I think, Franco Bracani ends up as the scriptwriter or uncredited scriptwriter on Sex of the Witch. And even though Panaccio took the main credit, and this could have been to do with union rules, because there were a lot of union rules at the time as to who could be credited and not. So credits often get very confusing on Italian films from this period. But he scripted this, and when you know Bracani, this lack of coherence in the narrative, this almost deliberate pushback creating narrative coherence, this just seems to me very Bracani. I know when Roberto Curti wrote about this film, and he provided some excellent production info on this, which I'll discuss further down the line in the track, and was able to go into the censorship records and things like that, which is amazingly helpful, because, you know, hardly anything ever written about Panaccio, hardly anything ever written about Bracani. Curti, like many others, although he picks out some interesting things about the film, he also calls it an inept film, and he mentions Bracani in passing as a painter who also made Necropolis, but doesn't really go into the context of who Bracani was or what he did or what his philosophy was, let alone the mystery of how these two, what seemed like opposing forces when it comes to their approach to film, got together. Admittedly, though, Bracani, even now, even though he was one of the few, very few experimental Italian filmmakers from this period, is yet to register anywhere as having any importance. But he also then, Bracani, co-scripted or uncredited scripted Panaccio's next film starring Richard Conti, which is like a really weird, surreal exorcist ripoff, Naked Exorcism, aka Return of the Exorcist, or in one weird edition, I think it was the UK one, it was released as The Exorcist 3 Cries and Shadows as one of its alternate titles. Very, very, very strange film. Not quite as incoherent as Sex of the Witch, but there's a trademark there. You can see Bracani's influence on these scripts. And especially when it comes to things like the nightclub orgy scene later on, you know, this seems to come from Bracani's world, this counterculture, very anti-establishment, anti-commercial world that's all about art, reinventing the wheel, getting rid of the traditional and kicking back at the establishment. And he writes these two things, which are basically genre cinema. And I just find this aspect really fascinating. It just goes to show, I think, how fluid the Italian industry was at the time, and also how very closed it was and small. So you quite often get these, and I hate the terms high-low, but these high-low figures mixing in the same social circles. Very, very fluid, very, very tight-knit community. And so that's how, I guess, you get someone like Bracani ending up. And it's very much the same way that you see Jess Franco working with the very, very experimental Spanish filmmaker Pere Portabella, who did like a behind-the-scenes experimental presentation of Franco's Count Dracula, and was just a deeply political, in fact, he went on to be a politician, but a deeply political underground filmmaker, went on from that to do Umbrical the same year, which is just an incredible film, not to go on too much of a digression, but stars Christopher Lee. You have like a drone soundtrack, chickens being mashed up in a factory before Christopher Lee comes on singing opera or wanders around in a museum reciting verses from Edgar Allan Poe's The Raven. Absolutely bonkers. So it's the same sort of thing, the coming together of these two different forces. We've left Evelyn the Ant. I haven't talked about anything that's going on in the film yet, and I promise I will. Evelyn the Ant is just my favourite thing in this as well. But I think the point I'm making is I think you have to consider the presence of Bracani in this film to really understand its more surreal qualities. It doesn't really function as a traditional giallo in that respect, although it also kind of is. You have the Agatha Christie body count by numbers plot initially. Obviously, it goes way, way off the beaten path in terms of its conclusion. But it initially throws you this curveball, or I guess a bait and switch, that it's going to be one of these Agatha Christie type setups where everybody inherits this money at the age of 30. But if they die before the money gets to them, if they die, then that money goes back into the pot and it's shared out by the remaining survivors, say. And there's a lot of money to be shared out and a lot of heads. So it starts off as what looks like a fairly traditional mystery inheritance plot. Within the giallo, because I'll talk about giallo, and I always talk about giallo, but there's so many misconceptions about giallo, one of them being that it has to be this Dario Argento-esque, Mario Bava-esque, black-gloved killer and stylized violence and so on and so forth. But really, giallo is just a pulp mystery. And within the giallo, especially before the pre-Argento period, so before the 70s, giallo meant something very different. We kick off with Blood and Black Lace in 64, and I apologize, but I always seem to be going back over this. But I think it's a point that needs to be made. We have Blood and Black Lace that sets up many of the recurring motifs, like the stylized violence, the black killer. But then we go into more melodramatic giallo at the end of the 60s, the stuff that Umberto Lenzi was making with Carol Baker, for example. And they really are much more akin to the erotic or eroticized, very human-focused thrillers that people like Claude Chabrol would make in France. And they also borrow a lot from Gothic melodrama. So themes of gaslighting, inheritance plots, so on and so forth. And within that, you also get then the Agatha Christie model, because the giallo takes its name from the old paperbacks that were translated Mondadori Press, in that they had yellow covers and they were reprints of people like Edgar Wallace, Agatha Christie, Arthur Conan Doyle, you know, that sort of thing. But interestingly, there isn't a lot of that sort of thing, not the more traditional angle in the giallo. It becomes something else. But you do get a few. You get, for example, The Weekend Murders probably does it the best. And these ones are usually set in England as well. You've got the Spanish one, The Killer is One of 13, where there's some family member basically bumping off everybody to get their hands on the inheritance. And this one follows the same trend in that it's supposedly shot in England. But actually, just break away for a second here to point out we have more extended footage of the sleaze here. And these two servants really do love to get it on. And it seems to be predominantly them so far in the featured cut sections, because they are really, really going for it. Back to England, though. I think the problem with this picture is the fact that, given the fact that they had a very, very, very tiny budget on this one, there's really no attempt to make this look like England, although they never quite pull it off anyway. I think The Weekend Murders probably does it the best in that respect. It has this sort of proto Midsummer Murders vibe about it. Definitely, but very few of them pull it off. And so this is supposed to be set in England. You've got this family, the Hiltons, right? But they live in what's quite clearly an Italian villa. I live in Britain. We don't have buildings like this. As Roberto Curti pointed out in his Gothic book, the cars have Italian plates. And when you look at the furniture, this very Baroque sort of Mediterranean style of furnishing. Nope, nobody has that in Britain either. So there really is, I think, to enjoy a film like Sex of the Witch, you really have to abandon any idea that this is going to follow a logical plot. What it seems to do instead is really focus on the transgressions and what's considered to be, I guess, the inherent evil in this weird family, the Hiltons, and everybody that surrounds them. And in that respect, it is a very Gothic film, because traditional Gothic, starting off with things like Walpole's Castle of Otranto, for example, all about this idea of heredity, all about this idea of class and curses. And so we're introduced to this idea that the Hiltons, and I just love that they chose that name. And also you get the connection, I don't think this was their thinking in naming them Hiltons, but George Hilton, king of the giallo, you get that connection. But you get, I guess, this conscious attempt to link it to a more British sort of Gothic, although it's clearly very, very Mediterranean, very, very Latin in its stylization, and obviously a lot of that is to do with budget. And maybe they just didn't care. I don't care either. I think it's a wonderful thing. It brings you into a very strange universe populated with very, very strange people. And so a lot of the mystery of this film is, who the hell are these people? Who the hell are these people? And what the hell is going on here? And by the end of the film, you're still thinking that. It's just like, absolutely great. I have to mention this bizarre throwaway comment to the injury there, purely as an excuse for her to then take her top off and look at her own breasts in the mirror. So much censorship involved in this type of work, though. It was the same thing with Panaccio's 1975 film, so his Exorcist ripoff. Various cuts made to that film as well. And that one is another one that goes into Gothic territory. It's not, I'm calling it an Exorcist ripoff, but it isn't really that. It uses the idea of the Exorcist, but it's much more, I think, much more akin to the Gothic literature that I'm talking about. It has this real perverse edge to it. And of course, with the Bracani script input, it has, I don't know, it's like walking into a surreal dream, some of it, in that it's a young man who is possessed by this demonic spirit of a woman. So jumping ahead a bit, but you do have that gender-bending twist at the end of this. And there's a kind of gender-bending twist to The Exorcist in Pinacchio's next film, in his The Exorcist Returns, or Exorcist 3. And I think that's one of the things I really love about Italian Eurocult, is this resistance to formula, even outside of using avant-garde filmmakers to write your scripts. We're into this psychedelic section now, though. And this is one of the things that people always remember about this film. It's abrupt. It is very, very stylized. It comes out of nowhere. But this is to show you that Cousin Johnny, the oldest one, so the one who's about to inherit the money in a few weeks, this is what he gets up to in his spare time. He is a naughty boy. He goes to these swinging clubs and everyone's there getting stoned and getting involved in orgies, so on and so forth. You know, just par for the course for a 70s counterculture libertine, I guess. But people tend to remember this because it stands out. They're like, hey, yeah, that film with the weird club scene in the middle of it. What I love about this is you then had in 1972, for example, studios like Hammer consciously trying to bring counterculture and hippie culture into horror to update their formula. Following the success of things like Count Yorga to appeal to a younger audience, and you get in that these scenes with this band called Stoneground and this libertine figure called Johnny Alucard, played by Christopher Neame. Wonderful, wonderful. But, and I mean this in the most loving way, because I absolutely adore Dracula AD 1972. Absolutely adore it. I just think it's a weird, strange film, and it occupies a weird, strange energy. And occupies a strange position as well in Hammer's experimental period. But when you see people like Stephanie Beecham with a cut glass sort of English diction talking to Peter Cushing, who's supposed to be the Van Helsing figure, talking about the furs and these hippies, they're so wild. What they do is they hang out in coffee bars and drink coffee. And they have this stoner band who were actually a band, but everybody else looked like they just came out of the green room for some cultural affairs show in the BBC, and knowing Hammer, they probably did as well. It's just like, this really isn't any form of sort of realistic interpretation of counterculture. This just looks like, you know, at the school disco when the geography teacher gets up and dances to pop music. Like he's trying to fit in with the kids and everyone's kind of cringing and smiling along. It's a bit like that. Whereas in Sex of the Witch, what you get is something that feels entirely authentic. And it stands out to people for that, because they're not used to seeing this in a genre film. They're not used to seeing something so crazy. Does the same thing, actually, in The Exorcist Returns or Naked Exorcism. In that film, it's not crazy club scenes, but the narrative is like, it's like something that's so out of tone with what you've been watching so far that it kind of ruptures and slaps you around the face. But there's scenes in that. There's a nun who was, and this isn't a spoiler if you haven't seen it, but she was institutionalized. She was in a mental hospital. And her flashbacks are these very abrupt, very almost violent flashbacks to this mental asylum that are shot on different stock, and they're just like crazy. They're just absolutely crazy, and you're just like, what is that? So it's the same sort of thing. It's like, we're not going to ease you into this. We're just going to bring you into this man's trip. And I just think it's a great aspect to the film. And no wonder that it's the thing that people tend to remember from that. And then we go back into, I guess, a more conventional giallo territory in terms of its cinematography, because we start to get these point of view tracking shots, and this is the first time, nearly 30 minutes in, that we're in a film that's barely an hour and a half long, but these are just so standard giallo, that we're in giallo territory and we're in the killer's point of view. Cinematography on this is so moody in parts, though, and I wanted to make a note on the cinematographers, and also the fact that there's not enough medieval murder weapons used for my liking in the giallo. Slaughter Hotel is probably the best of those in terms of examples, but this one with some sort of medieval mace is incredible. The two cinematographers, Maurizio Santini, he did some really sleazy stuff. And neither of the cinematographers on this were really cinematographers who worked in the giallo or in the gothic film. With Maurizio, outside of working with Panaccio, he shot things like Mandinga and SS Experiment Love Camp. But I think most importantly, he worked closely with Alberto Cavalloni on his infamous film Blue Movie from 1978 and 1980's follow-up to that, Blowjob. So working in much more sleazy territory. And then you also have Girolamo La Rossa, also credited as a cinematographer. He wasn't as prolific and just shot a lot of very obscure stuff, obscure in English language territory. And Donald O'Brien's turned up. I'll talk about him in a minute. But the closest, I guess, he gets to Sex of the Witch is Night of the Damned from 1971, which is a weird gothic film. I think the one thing Restoration shows is how gothic and atmospheric some of the elements of this film are. Talking of gothic, though, I don't know why there's a Buddha there. And then you've also got this recurring mystery of those fingernails that doesn't seem quite explained. One of the aspects of this film that really fascinates me is its position in a very small subset of giallo films that use the occult. So, for example, you had, just the year before this, Sergio Martino's All the Colours of the Dark. You had Short Night of the Glass Dolls, Pupi Avati's a little bit later on, The House with Laughing Windows. And interestingly, to go back to Bracani, because it all comes back to Bracani, Necropolis, in one of the reviews in the Italian press, was paralleled with the early work of Pupi Avati as filmmakers who were emerging in what outwardly, on paper at least, looked like horror film, but were actually using it in an experimental way. And Pupi Avati, though, his horror films are very experimental, but they're at least coherent. I think Bracani was much more of an outlier and he really wasn't interested in coherence at all. But you get this small subset of Italian giallo films that draw from the occult. And Kim Newman wrote about them and called them giallo fantastico. Baba Yaga, even though I'd argue it's not really a giallo, but it is a mystery film, is another one that falls into that strange little canon. I think there's this tendency to assume, because we know that Eurocult is weird, it's wild, it's often much more sleazy than its British or American counterpart. There's often much more surrealism there. We often think, oh, this was just the Italian way. But to go back to Sergio Martino for a second with All the Colours of the Dark. Now, that film is a giallo that revolves around a woman who may or may not have psychic visions. A very gothic giallo with black mass and all these occult themes. And Sergio said in his autobiography you know, and it's a much loved giallo. When the film was first screened to audiences domestically, it was booed because the audiences didn't understand the surreal aspects. They didn't like the fact that Edward Fenwick's psychic powers or visions or whatever they were weren't explained, and they didn't like the dreamlike elements of it. So I think we assume this was just the Italian way and people accepted this and they were much more open to this. And certainly within Eurocult, there was much more of an openness to things like the fantastique, for example, things that weren't so clearly defined, things that were much more nebulous. But Italy's domestic market was largely, you know, young people, working class people who were just going off to the movies. And there was a strong culture there, film watching culture there, even though the industry was under pressure at this point in the 70s. But they would go for a laugh and a doss and want to watch a horror film. And they really didn't respond to these more surrealistic aspects. And I think that explains why Pinacchio's film, which is much more surreal than something like All the Colours of the Dark, why it was a commercial failure, why he struggled to get so much traction when it came to making genre films. And it was pretty much the same case with The Exorcist Returns. He had made westerns before this. He like dabbled in and out of films. And then by the end of the 70s, he was making porn. He was making films like Luce Rossa, making outright pornography. But people weren't accepting of this. They wanted the explanation. They wanted to know. It's only, I think, in the realm of home video that a lot of these films have been reassessed. And Sex of the Witch, I wouldn't say it's a massive cult classic, even within that domain, but it definitely is a title that makes people curious. And my curiosity around it comes mainly from the use of the occult, but also the way it uses Gothic as well. I think it's got a really interesting way of using the Gothic, especially when it comes to that heredity theme. And I'll expand on that. But in terms of the way it uses the occult, it is very, very ambiguous. So you get Sex of the Witch, a title like Sex of the Witch, which is a direct translation from the Italian title, sets up an expectation that goes back to the previous decade. It goes back to the Italian Gothic cycle. It goes back to things like Black Sunday, for example. It goes back to this notion that was very much entrenched in Italian Gothic through that classic period in the 1960s, where you had a prevalence of female monstrosity or witch-type figures or cursed, female cursed figures, ghosts, things like this. Sex of the Witch, it kind of pitches that to the audience, yet made in the 1970s. So, of course, things are much more permissive by now. So I guess this sort of gives the idea of something like Devil's Wedding Night. Like, you're going to get Rosalba Neri at the end, naked in a black mass, perhaps. It sets up a certain expectation in line with the other films that were being made. And it really doesn't do that. It is completely counter to that. And obviously, a lot of Italian films would, especially within the giallo, they would give these crazy titles. It's all about the title. But Sex of the Witch is really not about that. I couldn't even think of a fitting name for this film. The use of the occult as a tool for revenge, though, is something that comes up in a couple of these occult giallo films. And I don't want to say which ones because I don't want to spoil it, but it's an aspect that really fits into the nebulous and oftentimes ambiguous nature of the giallo. Is something that was forever shifting and redefining itself. And by the 70s, starting to incorporate more avant-garde, deliberately stylized aspects of genre film, especially around that turn of the 70s. You get quite a lot of psychedelic giallo films coming out around that time. All the Colours of the Dark is a really good example of that. Not an occult giallo, but A Lizard in a Woman's Skin is another one by Lucio Fulci, uses sort of dreamlike imagery, and Fulci would use occult elements within the giallo later on in very different ways. One in Don't Torture a Duckling, in one way that goes back to superstition, in another way in The Psychic, which is, you know, as the title says, is about a woman with psychic powers who has visions. So I love the fact that the giallo was able to encompass aspects of the earlier Gothic, but update them and bring them into these murder mystery plots. And this scene, again, this, I said this was not like the Argento films, but the scene in the park, this is something that's very evocative of that era of more conventional giallo, and the way that the camera tracks this woman is, well, you get the idea. Or the anticipation that a murder's about to occur, and it doesn't. It doesn't. So it's using, I guess, established tropes to set up expectation, but then not delivering on them. And I guess that could be frustrating if you were not of an open mind. I really want to talk about Evelyn, about this actress, and we're not seeing her face yet, who plays Aunt Evelyn. Jessica Dublin, though, because she is interesting. A New Yorker who exclusively built her film career in Italy, starting actually in very, very small parts with some of the big auteurs. So she had an uncredited role in Fellini's Satyricon, and you can see why. She's got a really fascinating face, and Fellini was all about the face. She was in Visconti's The Damned, but then very quickly went into supporting roles in more genrefied films, so Fragment of Fear from 1970. She was in The Western Trinity Is Still My Name. She, talking of the giallo, she did So Sweet, So Dead in 1972, and that was her biggest role to date, I think. Even in this, which is quite a weighty role for her compared to her previous ones, she's really the main catalyst for all this weird crap to be happening. Evelyn is a peripheral character. She's omnipotent because they all fear her, and there's this legend about her, but we don't really see very much about her and what she does. She married the director, Panaccio, the same year of Sex of the Witch. After this, though, while she was still married to Panaccio, they divorced in 1980, although I'm not sure if they separated at any point. She goes off to Greece and she starts working with exploitation legend Nico Mastorakis. So my introduction to her was as the sleazy old woman in the infamous video Nasty Island of Death from 1976. Where she gets a golden shower in the face and not in an erotic way. And she's also in Mastorakis's Death Has Blue Eyes from 76, which sounds like a giallo, but is, again, a very weird occult. It just makes absolutely no sense. It's incredibly entertaining, as was the bulk of Mastorakis's work. Very, very cheap, very, very trashy. And she plays this girl's mother. The girl has a psychic power, and she hires basically two layabouts who like drinking and sleeping around to protect her daughter, who has these weird telekinetic psychic powers. I mean, it's just a mess. She was also in Death Steps in the Dark in an uncredited role again in 77. But it's one of these, and she's way off screen by now, but I have to mention Jessica Dublin because I just think another interesting little mystery to this film is, how the hell did she end up marrying someone like Panaccio? How the hell did she end up in Greece working for someone like Mastorakis. It's like just the stuff that was going on in Europe at the time, absolutely wild, absolutely wild. And I just think it's wonderful. How did this woman, at the age of nearly 50, end up in something like Island of Death, where she tries to get off with the young Christopher in there and receives a face full of urine for her troubles? Absolutely insane. And as a side note, she actually ended her career working with Troma on Toxic Avenger sequels. Just wild. Talking of wild, I have to talk. So let's come back to what's actually happening in Sex of the Witch. The reason I focus so much on context and the relationships around this film is I just think it is just such a fascinating subject of how this film came about and what was being drawn into it, because it is total anarchy in a way, and these sleazy shots are trying to be somewhat artistic, which I find interesting. But in terms of characters, we have these servants who are as perverse as the family, and they like to, I mean, they are just libidinal. We met them at the beginning having sex during old man Hilton's funeral, for example. One of them, played by Franco Garofalo, who is just incredible, Tony, he just had such a weird presence and was in some really amazing cult stuff. He also appeared in Panaccio's Exorcist film. But things like Hell of the Living Dead, for example. I have to say, though, Sex of the Witch is definitely his sleaziest role, it has to be, within genre film. You'll notice, if you know this film well, that we have slipped into another extended scene that was previously cut. Now, this one is long. We've got about an extra 8 minutes of softcore sex footage. When you think about Sex of the Witch and like where it, the place, I guess, it occupies in Italian cult cinema, it is at the obscure end of the spectrum, especially within the giallo, but just within Eurocult in general. And I think people might have remembered the film a bit more if these scenes had remained intact from the first point onwards. What stands out to me about them, apart from the fact that you have a lot of Franco Garofalo's ass, and he even gets his balls out earlier on, is the fact that they are incredibly sensual. And there is so much more emphasis on the sexual aspects and sensual sexual aspects and eroticism than there is violence in this film. Within the giallo, you generally get, when it comes to sex, it's this more perverse type of sex, or it's used within the storyline, like Sergio Martino. I've mentioned All the Colours of the Dark quite a few times. That one's quite a sensual film, but there's more of an overwhelming emphasis on violence than anything else. Whereas if you take this into account, Sex of the Witch becomes a very different animal, because it is sensual and violence really is kept to a minimum. Outside of the mace murder, for example, it's really more about softcore aspects. And this was quite unusual for a giallo in the early 70s. Post 75, when you get into things like Strip Nude for Your Killer, for example, in the later 70s giallo, they'd gone all on out into total sleaze. But in those earlier years of the giallo, so 70, 71, 72, 73, when there's still quite a bit of censorship, generally you don't see an awful lot of softcore sex in them. So I'm not sure what Panaccio was going for when he decided to put essentially like a complete softcore three-way in here that runs over 10 minutes long with plenty of shots of Franco's naked backside. And I actually read a funny review of this that described him as if someone had forced Klaus Kinski to wear David Hemming's hair, and it wasn't a pretty sight. But for the Giallo, this approach to just the sheer amount of softcore sex was pretty unusual for 1973. Post-75, when things had opened up even more in Italy, it was not so unusual. And by 78, you even had hardcore entering domestic genre products. So things like Joe D'Amato's Images in a Convent or Malabimba being examples of that, as Italy, what they called their red light cinema, started to blossom in the very late 70s. But 73, this was unusual, and I would imagine these extended scenes, which would no way have been allowed through in domestic cuts, would have been made more for the export market. But the fact they never made it to export is a kind of a curiosity. And although Giallo films were very gratuitous for their era, very few went this far at this period. And the only thing that I can think of specifically within the Giallo that comes close to this is Fernando De Leo's Slaughter Hotel from 1971. And I mentioned that earlier because there's also that link to medieval murder weapons. But in that one, you've got, in certain cuts of that film, you've got Rosalba Neri. There are inserts of her finger in herself. Well, it's clearly a body double, so I should say her character fingering herself. And it's interesting, actually, because Marzia Damon, who plays the maid in this, and she'd actually appeared in Billy, The Demon of Incest, the year before this, as a maid in that as well, and she'd done like sexy Decamerons and stuff as well. She actually looks a bit like Rosalba Neri, and she's playing that sort of Rosalba Neri role. And then she'd later go on and turn up in another gothic giallo, The Bloodsucker Leads the Dance, 1975. But I do find myself wondering, in the case of Slaughter Hotel, that seems to have had a much wider distribution. And those insert scenes, although not full-on hardcore, were for more of an international market. And if you think in the US, they already had hardcore in cinemas. So it really wasn't much of a big deal for American audiences at that time. But in Italy, it was. What Panaccio was thinking when he was like, let's just have this massive three-way sequence that just goes on and has absolutely nothing to do with the story, other than to remind us that these two servants are actually probably having more sex than their masters. And they just, I don't know how they get any work done, because anytime you see them, they're just stripping off and having sex. There's no point to that. I don't know what Panaccio's trying to tell us, other than it makes them weird and perverse in a way. But the sex scenes they're in are quite, other than that weird poker scene and the fact that they got into a coffin to do it once, they're kind of vanilla. So, you know, there's not even any point to this in terms of it being like sadism. But this is really out there for a 1973 giallo feature. And there were certain directors that used like a more sensual sexual angle. I mentioned Sergio Martino's All the Colours of Dark. That one uses it in a way, but nowhere near this level of gratuity and, you know, so much emphasis on ass and bush as well. In a way, this foreshadows Panaccio's later career, though, when he would go into hardcore film and he would go into proper pornography, making a number of porn films, either under the name of Angel Valerie or Gerard B. Lennox was another pseudonym he used. And so in that way, although not as prolific, he shares some sort of, I guess, cosmic energy with Joe D'Amato, in that he was somebody who wasn't afraid to embrace pornography and somebody who also used more pornographic elements, even this early on, in genre film, like 73, Joe D'Amato would start around the same time making erotic genre films as well. I think this is the one of the things about the actual story, if you can call it that, though, that intrigues me about the film. The way that it uses gothic, quite often in literary gothic, and it stems back to the really early stuff. And I'm going to mention my favourite Matthew Lewis's The Monk, for example, although, in fact, that works with occult themes. That has occult themes in it. But you get this, I guess, this idea of original sin. These aristocratic characters who were born under a curse, so to speak. They're born under a curse. They are infected from the moment they're born. And traditional Gothic, literary Gothic, is all about these perversions, these inbuilt original sins, the fact that people are incredibly corrupt, in a way. You get that idea. And this film, and this goes back to Bracani's work. If you look at his short film, for example, on William Blake, which is a really interesting, again, surrealistic, experimental underground short film, but it really is a thesis on the nature of evil and how all evil stems from the body. It stems from pleasures of the flesh. And he also uses this thesis about evil in Necropolis. And so whilst we do have a loose giallo working around these very perverse characters, I think, again, this is the influence of Bracani, in that the focus really is on their transgressions and their perversions, for example. So we get this history of this Hilton family and how messed up they are. And in fact, the latest sort of carnation of the Hiltons, they're quite straight. They're quite vanilla in terms of their perversions, because we hear the, you know, one was a pirate rapist and another one was a mad doctor. So they've got this really interesting backstory to them that's very, very strange, that they are somehow tainted with sin. And this thesis starts very early on in the film, when old man Hilton is on his deathbed and he's looking at the entire family and he's commenting on them. He's telling you how corrupt they are. Like I said, the extent of their corruption really just goes to the fact that they're all having somewhat, I presume, incestuous sex with one another. It never makes it clear what the relationships are, but I guess they're all cousins, they're all quite tight-knit, this family. So there seems to be a lot of incest or at least interbreeding in this family line. And this goes back to a very, very traditional Gothic form. And I really enjoy this part of the, again, plot. I'm not sure you could call it that, but the underpinnings of that, I think it riffs so heavily off the idea of Gothic perversion. And that perversion is spanned to the servants. It's spanned to the servants that are somehow more libidinal, more perverted than their masters. But you get this idea that they've been there for a long time, and so therefore they're living the Hilton way. You know, this is the code. This is the code of the Hilton house. And we don't know what the old man got up to, but we know that Evelyn has gone off and become a witch and everyone's terrified of her. But that doesn't stop them from getting into bed and stripping off and having sex with one another, you know, and really channeling that. Johnny was probably the most libertine of them all, and his transgressions extended to going to hippie orgies, which really doesn't seem all that transgressive, and I absolutely love this. I think that was as far as they could push it, though, and even that attracted a certain amount of censorship from the authorities, which you know, around this time, even though things were opening up, was still a problem for Italian filmmakers in that things would still frequently get cut around this point. Although things had loosened up considerably from the 60s. And in terms of that content, weirdly, given how Italy was drenched in this Catholicism, more traditional values as a culture, the Italians always seemed to let far more through compared to, say, the American cuts of their films. And that was something that was especially true for someone like Mario Bava when some of his early films arrived in the States. They were cut to shreds. So even within that, they were always that much more permissive. We're coming up to Camille Keaton's big moment now. She is one of the cousins, Anne, who is mysteriously raped by this strange figure that later we find out is Ingrid in an occult shape-shifting form. And if you can give Sex of the Witch anything, I think there's always this assumption that giallo killers are male, and outsiders have labelled it a misogynistic genre because of that. But that's really not true. There are a lot of female killers. And this one has the most ingenious killer because it's really both genders. It's somebody who shapeshifts into a male body, which has to have some sort of award for being the most ingenious type of giallo killer. But Camille Keaton, obviously one of the biggest faces in this, really. Another American who predominantly made her film career in Italy. Her first film was for Massimo Dannemano in What Have You Done to Solange? And I would imagine it was a casting in Solange, which she'd done just the year before this, that put her in the running for the part of Anne, because you really see very little of Camille Keaton until this, like I said, strange rape scene, because why? Why not kill her? And after that, she is this traumatised woman who can, well, she can't speak. And you see she's very traumatised here. And poor old Camille Keaton seemed destined to have this recurring role after Solange. In Solange, again, she's a girl who's regressed into a childlike mute state because, and that is a Italian crime thriller giallo hybrid, but she's regressed into this childlike state because of PTSD, something terrible that happened to her. In this is Anne, she's very, very traumatized. And then of course in Miyazaki, the director who she eventually married, I Spit on Your Grave, that became her signature role, and the one that she's most asked about, in that she's a rape victim who then goes after revenge. In Solange, in this though, they're very much of this character type, that she is this passive, mute character who's very, very good at actually playing traumatised. But it's not a particularly nuanced role. It's not a role that really, I guess, offers much opportunity for Keaton to show her range. And of course, another big genre picture that she would appear in is Freda's Tragic Ceremony, which is another film that you see a cult. Interesting figure in the Italian film industry, Camille Keaton. And so it's perhaps not surprising when she was interviewed about her role in this film, or interviewed about her career overall, she said she couldn't remember anything really about Sex of the Witch, only that she turned to one of her fellow cast members. And I don't know if it was Sergio Ferrero, who plays quote-unquote Man Ingrid, and he just had a few very, very small supporting roles in various things, including an uncredited role in Barbarella from Roger Vadim. I don't know if it was him, but she's not in that many scenes, but she apparently turned around to one of her fellow colleagues and said, "Do you know what's going on?" And they were like, "No." They didn't even know what the film was about. Nobody knew. I want to mention Gianni D actually as Simon, because he's going to get killed pretty soon. He's another one, very perverse looking presence. And I mean that in the best way. But Patrick from Patrick Still Lives, it started off as a recurring joke on my podcast, Daughters of Darkness, where we started to discover all these late 70s Italian films, and this obviously is early 70s, seem to have a weird connection to Patrick Still Lives. And here we clearly have the granddaddy, because it's got Patrick himself and Gianni D. He was in that. He was also in Giallo in Venice, a sleazy, filthy, wonderfully filthy Giallo as well. Did some very interesting stuff. And there seems to be one, you've got sort of actors. Well, actually, Camille Keaton wasn't really established. The most established star, if you could perhaps call them that, in this is Donald O'Brien as the inspector, who I absolutely love. Donald O'Brien had some interesting things to say about this film, actually. He was an Irish actor who, again, ended up predominantly working in Italy, including in the title role of Dr. Butcher. So he did numerous Italian films where he was often credited as Donald, and it's one of the mainstay stories about him was how he had to change his name to Donald on his passport to cash checks when it was actually Donald. O'Brien was one of the few people that had memories of this production, and he was interviewed about his career twice, illuminating on the harsh circumstances under which they had to shoot. In his interview with Manlio Gomarasca, which was published in Cinema Nocturno, Italian zine, he said about this film, "That was a down-at-heel production indeed. We filmed it near Rome, and during the shooting, I didn't see two nickels to rub together. In fact, the rumours circulating were alarming. One night at the restaurant, I dared to ask about my wage, and the reply was, 'Do you want the money? It's already a lot if at the end of the day you won't have to pay for the hotel and the food.' And O'Brien said, 'I almost choked on my spaghetti.' He then told Christian Kessler in his much quoted, semi-legendary interview with O'Brien, Gunslingers, Cannibals and More, 'I remember that this production was so cheap we were thrown out of the hotel we were staying at. Believe it or not, we realised that each one of us would have to pay for himself. They sure had money trouble.' Now, how much of that is true, I don't know. And the story varies from piece to piece. And actors from the vintage era do have a habit of misremembering things. But it was certainly true that Pinacchio wasn't really an affluent filmmaker in any respect. And he doesn't seem to have been particularly commercially successful at all. Had already gone bankrupt once before he started directing his films. And actually, I'm just going to read the little synopsis that Roberto Curti gives on the director in his Italian Gothic book, because it's quite succinct and it goes over some of the key details of his career. So Curti says, born in Foglino in 1923 as Angelo Pinacchio, he moved at an early age to Rome, where he was bitten by the film bug. He studied at Rome CSC, which incidentally is where Bracani studied, and that might have been how they knew each other. And during that period, he collaborated on a few scripts, including Giulio Coletti's war drama Divisioni Folgori, 1954, but never graduated. He resurfaced in the movie business near the end of the 1960s and teamed up with the director Luigi Petrini for a couple of films before going bankrupt. And after his debut as a director, which was in Death Plays of Flute in 1972, Pinacchio founded another company, Universalia. Il Sesso della Strega, which is the Italian title for Sex of the Witch, came after an aborted project, a weird parapsychological yarn titled Subliminal, starring Kay Fisher and Gordon Mitchell, about a girl with telepathic powers who becomes the instrument of a vengeance against a former SS acolyte. Subliminal was abandoned halfway through shooting due to lack of funds. And this seems to be a cycle for Panaccio, in that he wasn't even particularly a journeyman in that way, and Curti refers to him as singular. And I definitely agree with that, because like Bracani, there seems this stubbornness to adhere to certain genre convention. And if you take this film, his Exorcist film, and then the unfinished Subliminal into account, he clearly had an interest in occult themes when it came to genre films specifically. In terms of this film's position in the canon of the giallo, though, and this is something I've yet to touch upon, we have this subgenre of occult giallo, obviously, and it has strains of that. But there's also the gothic giallo to consider, which is one of my favourite strains of the giallo overall. Throughout the 60s in Italy, the giallo reigned supreme as the dominant trend of horror film. But after Mario Bava, and ironically, it was obviously Bava who kicked off that popular cycle with the success of Black Sunday in 1960, after Bava made Blood and Black Lace in 64, you started to see throughout the latter part of the 60s this shift into more psychosexual, realistic horror, the sort of stuff that was inspired off the back of Psycho and Peeping Tom, and you get the giallo. I've already mentioned within those early Gianni films, though, the dominant model was this gothic melodrama, this twist on the gothic melodrama, a lot of them scripted by Ernesto Gastaldi, who was heavily influenced by 1960s Midnight Lace, a film with Doris Day, in which she's gaslit and stalked by a killer who phones her up and he terrorises her. And so a lot of those early giallo films were a kind of a riff on that. They also borrowed from Henri-Georges Clouzot's Diabolique quite a lot in the twists and the turns. But predominantly, they were gothic in nature. They went back to this idea of gothic romance and the gothic thriller, not specifically gothic horror, which revolved around the supernatural, mad science, say, the vampires and the witches and things like that. Not specifically that, I'm talking about the more romantic end of gothic, the Radcliffean tradition started by people like Anne Radcliffe, the things like Jane Eyre and Wuthering Heights, and these ideas of heredity as a curse and inheritance and all these things. By the 70s, filmmakers could be a lot more experimental and they could use a lot more sex. And what better way to get sex into a giallo than to use an underlying gothic plot? And I've mentioned All the Colours of the Dark, which is a really good example of a gothic giallo, in that it uses aspects of not just gothic melodrama, but also presumably or ambiguously supernatural. I love this fingering with a poker, by the way, talking of gothic perversion. But Martino also made Your Vice is a Locked Room and Only I Have the Key. We've also got Emilio Miraglia's The Night Evelyn Came Out of the Grave from 1971. Somewhat supernatural plot, but also very gothic and also about an inheritance. So you see it in that. And there were quite a few spin-offs to the gothic giallo, some of them period set. So you had films like Joe D'Amato's Death Smiles on a Murderer is another example. And the thing that these films had in common was, one, it was all about the focus on the perversion. So Evelyn, for example, and we've got another Evelyn here, you've got sadomasochism in that one. You had that in it. Predominance of perversion, heavily crimes heavily motivated by sexual perversion, things like that. Sometimes the occult is well in with that. But a real sort of highlighting of heredity as a curse in that way, and these people who were contaminated or corrupted through this idea of original sin. And it's something that crops up time and time again. A lot of family themes in the gothic giallo, but you also get these more out there, more outlandish, more surrealistic aspects, more psychedelic aspects, as we see here. It's not really explained. I mean, this in terms of its use of witchcraft is really interesting, because the witch occupied an interesting place in Italian horror film as well. Not used in the standard fairy tale way. Quite often the witch would divert from the standard tropes, so you'd get a lot of glamorous witches. The Witch in Love, which is a kind of horror, kind of drama crossover, being a good example of that from the mid-60s, for example. Or The Demon with Dahlia Lavi. Brunello Rondi's film. You know, these different conceptions of witches. And the way that Evelyn is a witch is she's a very contemporary witch. So this denies viewers the black mass scene and the candles and all the really over-the-top gothic relish in favour of something that is far stranger, but also far more contemporary and far more modern. And ironically, the director would actually use the more black mass standard for his Exorcist film. And Franco Garofalo in that plays this Satanist who you see at the beginning of the film performing the full, fully fledged black mass, complete with candles and naked woman. Sex of the Witch in that respect, and I touched on this earlier on in terms of that title, it's out to do something completely different with the idea of the witch, bringing it into this gothic inheritance plot. And we see old man Hilton at the beginning, he curses Evelyn as being this very evil figure, and that is a very specifically gothic thing, this idea of people being born into sin and a curse that comes through a bloodline that they're unable to escape, basically, because it's in the blood. You have that in the early stages of this film, in that Evelyn is the outcast because she seemingly embraced witchcraft. She is a horrible, evil figure. And as it turns out, and it comes into the weird climax, she's been using Ingrid the entire time as her tool. And she has that speech in the previous scene. It's like, you are just my tool. You're a creature and you're pliable and whatnot. I think this weird little strain, and I really love this part, almost riffs on the idea of the gothic creature. You know, the brainwashed henchman or the brainwashed creature or the mad doctor who invents a creature or builds a creature to do their evil bidding. It's a riff on that. But instead of using mad science, they use witchcraft as a vehicle to have this change in the character of Ingrid, so she can come in and out of the house undetected because she has the ultimate disguise. Old Johnny D's gonna get his moment now. He is just so wonderful, I think. I didn't touch on the start. They try, and the other characters try and carve him out as perverse in this suggestion that he's a secretary and may have been having a love, like he's gay, he likes men. And we see that's not entirely true, and he may be gay or he may be bisexual. But like everybody associated with the Hilton family, he's complex. And those eye close-ups that we're seeing in this scene, again, we've gone straight into conventional giallo territory, the cutthroat razor, the close-up of the eye. So there is some attempt to borrow or use giallo convention. But like I've been saying all along, the film sets up those conventions only to deconstruct them. It certainly uses that convention in terms of the murder. But that said, Sex of the Witch isn't a particularly high head count, really. And it's more of a slow, brooding family drama. And this seems to be what the script's focusing on. And again, I don't know if that comes from Bracani. He seemed to have this recurring theme or fascination in his own work on the nature of humanity, the nature of the soul, existential questions that he'd often explore through the medium of art, for example. And he did this with his short work on the writings of William Blake, for example. He also gave his thesis on cinema and was a morbid soul, I think, and maybe naturally attracted to horror because of that. Some of his short films, even though they're not genre in any way, they're nightmarish, all black and white, very nightmarish in his use of imagery. But he seems to delve consistently into these big existential themes regarding the notion of sin, regarding the notion of evil, regarding, in the case of Blake, the purpose of the soul, how the body is vulnerable to evil. You know, he seems to come back to these things. And if you take that into consideration, and that's why I started this track with a big emphasis on Bracani, I think if you take that into consideration, Sex of the Witch makes a lot more sense, because it really is just another essay on evil people, what corrupts them. Why are people evil? Why do people do the things that they do? It seems much more focused on that, and therefore much more in line with the stuff that Franco Bracani was making himself. And you can see certain parallels to Necropolis, although stylistically Necropolis is much more experimental and much more, I'd say, visually stylized. I mean, it's an incredibly fascinating piece of work from a visual perspective. I encountered it in the research of my book on Harry Kummel's Daughters of Darkness from 1971, because I was specifically researching any connection to Bathory in cinema, and that was one of the things that came up, although the Bathory in Necropolis has nothing to do with the Bathory that we know from history or the Bathory that we know from horror film. But I still included it in my book because I wanted to show how Bathory had been used in cinema prior to the way it was used in genre film. And in that, it sounds like people are ad-libbing a lot of the time, but you get these quote-unquote evil figures from history, some of them which come purely out of fiction, and there is an emphasis on gothic fiction in that film with the character Frankenstein, for example. Ingrid, in a way, is a certain type of Frankenstein's monster, an unconventional Frankenstein's monster as well, who is really been moulded and used by Evelyn. So you have that wonderful riff on that. And here it's as if she becomes conscious of her evil doings, and she becomes conscious of what's happening, and she flees. So you get this compelling line that it's somewhat tragic, and that certainly comes out of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, this creature who's been created maybe against their own will. And when she wakes up and runs away and gets frightened because her humanity kicks in, she can't carry on doing what she's doing. She becomes aware of what's happening. You get this weird tragic note. It also, in the line of Ingrid, uses gothic dualism, which is one of my favourite strains of gothic. Dualism is used so much in the gothic, be it through a literal use of the gothic double. So something like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And incidentally, if anything comes close to this in gender-bending weirdness, it has to be Hammer's weird gender-bending riff on Dr. Jekyll, which has a serial killer who consciously shapeshifts into the opposite sex so they can carry out murders. Dr. Jekyll and Sister Hyde from 1971. So it seems to borrow from that, but takes it into very different territory, as Sex of the Witch does. I don't quite understand why the servant comes out and throttles Ingrid. because he seems to be on the side of evil, and it's all very confusing as to what team he bats for. Although, I think he's mainly on team finger my girlfriend with a poker and have threesomes, so it could be that. There is this element of unexpected tragedy, though, that really comes from the Gothic dualism, from things like Frankenstein as well. This idea of beast within man and our struggle to control it, which is such a core feature of Gothic, used in this way, specifically as a physical double as well, and it's quite ingenious. Like I said, there's only that one use that I can think of, really, in Dr. Jekyll and Sister Hyde that actually does this. Sometimes you get in the giallo this assumption it might be a male killer and it turns out to be a woman or vice versa. You get that. But this is really something else. And it just really turns into this unexpected territory just for its climactic scene, which is fantastic. And I don't think Sex of the Witch gets enough credit for its ingenious use of Gothic themes. I really don't. And I don't know if it's just me, because none of the characters are really established outside of, I guess, their transgressions and their sex lives, obviously. But when it comes to this scene, I find it weirdly sympathetic. I don't want Ingrid to die. It's kind of sad, even though we don't really know very much about her or anybody else for that matter. But then character development within the ensemble giallo has never been much of a high point. You get characters who look shifty, for example, or do questionable things, and that's the only thing we ever know about them, and it works to build this tension when you're looking at several people who could be a murderer. And Sex of the Witch functions very much along those standard lines in that way. It doesn't really let us into any of the family secrets. And it seems that some of the cast have been cast, like Franco, for example, deliberately because they look a certain type. Although I would imagine with the budget on this thing, they also accepted anyone who would work on it, including Donald O'Brien, bless him. He did some crazy stuff in Italian film, although this has to be one of the craziest. And that little flashback now, and it's revealed who she really is. And they're just so sad, but they don't kind of question it. It's like, hang on a minute, what happened? It's almost like a werewolf transformation as well. Going back to that idea of the creature, where they kill the werewolf and they then go back in death to who they were. I find that really interesting. I don't know if anyone else has. I'm going to assume if you're still with me at this point in the track, you're still here looking for answers. Unfortunately, as we come down to the end, I can't give you all those answers. I don't think anyone can. I think the sad thing about this film is it's been so obscure for so long. And Panaccio and even Franco Braccani, given what a force he was in the Italian underground, have never been given any type of considerable study. The film is written about frequently in this offhand way, as if this is just some throwaway thing. It's cheap, it's really erotic, it doesn't make any sense, just this throwaway product. But hopefully through the process of this commentary, I've shown that there are some really interesting themes in this film. And yes, it does take something to connect the dots, but I really take Sex of the Witch and films like it much more like a mood piece. It's a Gothic mood piece. It's something that exists within the canon of the giallo, but its place there is as the strange, freakish child, mutant child locked away in the basement that nobody really talks about. And so hopefully with the new restoration, it will get more appreciation, especially now we've seen some of the missing scenes uncovered. I think if Sex of the Witch is proof of anything, though, it's the early 70s Italian film within genre was miles apart from the stuff being made in Britain and America in terms of its experimentation, its elements of fantasy, its elements of eroticism, the way they were using Gothic. I mean, it's just so out there. And it seems like to me, when you look back on that period, it was a time when anything was possible. And it really is possible if you look at the fact that this film actually got made, whereas Panaccio's Subliminal kind of conked out halfway through production. And it leaves us on this note with these people in their rooms and these two servants closing the door. I'd never mentioned the HH on the doors, which is great, Hilton, the gold-plated HH, but the fact that they're left in these rooms just dead and nobody's recovered the bodies. But it gives you this weird, it's like, on one hand, it's weird. It's like, why have they done this? But on the other, it's like this cynical note that they can never escape. And I like that, especially. Poor old Camille Keaton, Anne, she's just there mouthing gibberish. She's away with the fairies. Well, presumably, the rest of her relatives are going to rot away with their throats slit in the adjoining rooms. And the servants there, they're just going to carry on having their own private orgy while all this goes on. And so it leaves on a particularly cynical note. And this is very much the same thing that Panaccio did then later on with his Exorcist film, in that has no resolution. It doesn't give you this standard resolution where evil is overcome and you get this answer as to who was the killer and blah 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 and everything's fine by the end. His Exorcist film does the pretty much the same thing, in that you think, oh yes, evil's been defeated, it's all over, it's wonderful, it's, you know, it's free, and then it just ends with this like really cynical sort of punchline at the end. And this is cynical in the way that Camille Keaton's character Anne has been left there, but it also leaves with this almost absurd humour, giving Franco there the last word and then the crotch, which is quite the punchline. And all that leaves me to say is, if you stayed with me this far, thank you for listening. I'll let the crotch play us out to the end, although to be fair, it's kind of reserved considering what we've seen earlier on. We'll be right back.
and